Good evening, good evening. Thank you for allowing me to come back this evening. I didn't think y'all was going to put graffiti on my car. I was like, man, I don't know if I can come back. But I'm here, and I'm glad you guys did come back. And that says a whole lot that it wasn't me you came back for, it was the word that you came back for. So really quickly, before I kind of introduce this lesson, I wanted to read the lesson text that we're coming from. I had a text that I wanted Fred to read. I don't think we read that. But what we're going to do is read Luke. We're going to start reading really quick at Luke 23. We're going to read verses 13 through 15. Luke 23, verses 13 through 15. So it says, then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, you have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning those things of which you accuse him. No, neither did Herod, for I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. This morning our subject of focus was injustice. And we saw how it affects society today as it did in biblical times. Understanding that injustice comes in a form, a variety of forms, economically, politically, and socially. But on a more positive note, this evening's subject is on justice. We will quickly see what the law says concerning justice and what Christ did to bring about spiritual justice for all men. But not only does Jesus bring about justice, he offers grace. Since if all men were to receive justice, you know what we'll be, right? We'll be right on our way to hell. This morning we discussed many of the violations committed by the Sanhedrin during the trial, which caused me to title my lesson, The Greatest Injustice of All History. Their attitude against Jesus, his doctrine, and his disciples caused them to seek how they would put Jesus to death. We briefly discussed their plots during our morning lesson, and we came to understand that the Jews had a strict judicial system. That's how we learned that their entire case or trial should have been thrown out. However, since the judges in the case were the Sanhedrin and the Sanhedrin were the plaintiffs, this wasn't the case. The trial was commenced and Jesus was tried without reasonable cause. Now, earlier I mentioned that some sources note that this trial consisted of no less than 27 violations. I listed 21 earlier for the sake of time. Y'all caught that one, right? Now, the title of my lesson on this evening is Justice for All. In contrast, my earlier lesson was The Greatest Injustice of All History. Now, I want to go into the law of Moses really quickly before we get into this. This thing. Let us turn to Exodus 23:1-9. We're going to see what the law of Moses has to say about justice. Exodus 23:1-9. It says, you shall not circulate a false report. Do not put your hand with the wicked to be an unrighteous witness. You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice. You shall not show partiality to a poor man in his dispute. If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey going astray, you should surely bring it back to him again. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying under its burden and you will refrain from helping it, you shall surely help him with it. You shall not pervert the judgment of your poor in his dispute. Keep yourself far from a false matter. Do not kill the innocent and righteous, for I will not justify the wicked. And you shall take no bribe, for a bribe blinds the discerning and perverts the words of the righteous. Also, you shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, because you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Now, I really like verse 9. He said they should show justice to the stranger because they were strangers in the land of Egypt. This was a law given to God's people, towards those that were outside of God's people, those who dwelt among them. So in essence, he is saying, remember how you were treated in Egypt? Don't treat people like that. Don't treat people like that. Don't forget that it was me that brought you out of Egypt when he exercised justice on their behalf. So you must repay by dealing with these strangers the same way that I dealt with you. Really quickly, I want to turn over to Matthew 22. Verses 36 to 39. And this is a statement made by Jesus to a lawyer of the Pharisees. Now he said, Jesus said to him, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and great commandment, and the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. And I did fail to mention that the reason this question was asked, because these sects of Judaism, these sects would try to test Jesus and try to trip him up to accuse him of being disobedient in a sense to the law, of trying to topple the law in a sense. So this is how Jesus replied. Now, my question is, how many of us Christians in the church look at those in the world and don't show them justice because of where we are now? We were outside the church. We didn't have justice before the gospel. And then we get in the church and we fail to show justice to the stranger. Because sometimes we act like we've always been saved. We do. We act like we've always been in God's favor. But according to Romans 3, we're all sinners. Everybody is under the same condemnation. And we're all in need of saving. Nobody is better than anyone. Black, white, yellow, brown, or you may be orange. Rich or poor. Those that are still in the world and are still held by Satan stand in need of God's justice. And those in the church will save because of it. And we must remember that. It's a great thing that God isn't like us. Now, in the law, Deuteronomy 32 and 4 says he is the rock. His work is perfect. All his ways are justice. A God of truth. A God of truth without injustice. Now, before diving into more of the custom that we're going to see in just a second, I want to give you a little bit of background about Pilate and Herod. Remember, that is a section that we just read in Luke 22. Now, Pilate was the governor during this period in history, who was in place for about 10 years, starting at about AD 26. He was responsible for the regional administration and the tax collection, and his position gave him an earthly power over life and death, or to release and execute prisoners. His normal residence was in Caesarea Maritima, but he came to Jerusalem during the Jewish feast to keep an eye on things. Now, during this time, there were countless numbers of Jews. And also in this crowd would be a lot of zealous sects that would be ready to incite rebellion. So they had to keep an eye on things. And if anything got too out of hand, it would cause Pilate his position, even Herod, even the Jewish council. So Herod Antipas was the tetrarch over Galilee. And so this is why we're going to see Pilate attempt to hand Jesus over to Herod so that he would get rid of this petty Jewish matter. Like Pilate, Herod was in Jerusalem for the feast, but like Pilate, Herod too found no fault in Jesus, as we said earlier. But even this mutual reasoning made them who were once enemies friends. Now, as mentioned in the passage, I said it is in Jerusalem during the Passover feast. And all of the Jews are now gathered together to engage in Pilate's custom. Now, let's turn back to this passage so that we can remember what this custom is. Luke 22. Now, the Greek text suggests this to be Pilate's own custom. The custom here is Pilate releasing one prisoner during this time to the crowd, whomever they chose, whomever they wished. But sources, external sources, never mention this custom as a part of a Jewish custom. So it wasn't just prescribed in the law of Moses as well. So the Greek text would suggest that this was actually Pilate's own custom. So this was just something he did every year. Now, this custom Pilate used as another maneuver to release Jesus, having found no fault in him and realizing that Jesus had no intentions of toppling Rome or establishing some earthly kingdom at that time. Now, at the least, Pilate did know this man was handed over because of envy. Now, the first maneuver occurred during Jesus' last two trials, one of Pilate and the other of Herod. Pilate attempted to hand Jesus over to Herod to let him deal with the matter, as we just said, and even Herod, not taking the accusation seriously, handed him back to Pilate. He treated him with contempt and mocked him and arrayed him in a gorgeous robe in relation to the claims that he was the king of the Jews. Now, we will see once again later that Pilate eventually washed his hands of the matter, assumingly, after explaining to the crowd that neither him nor Herod could find any reason to condemn Jesus, even after a close interrogation. Now, of course, they still have to release a prisoner. So, which brings us to our next point. The criminals. Who were the two criminals? Barabbas and Jesus. Keep in mind that only slaves, murderers, thieves, and the likes were eligible for such an execution. And there were already criminals ready to be, or scheduled to be executed. Now, Pilate had come into town expecting to release a criminal and to execute or crucify the remaining criminals. But this wasn't the case, because what we're going to see is Pilate actually left town condemning or crucifying an innocent man. Now, let's look at the first criminal, Barabbas. Now, this person was mentioned by all four gospel writers, but they all described him in a different way. Pretty much the same, but different. Now, I would say that this would be God providing a contrasting case through providence, but we really don't know for sure. Nevertheless, there is a great contrast between these two, and it is too great to miss. Barabbas is identified by Mark and Luke as a rebel and a murderer. Matthew describes him as a notorious prisoner, and John identifies him as a robber. So Barabbas would represent the foulest of sinners, a notorious sinner. And then some ancient manuscripts of Matthew and some important figures in the early church also mentioned that Barabbas' full name was Jesus Barabbas. And this is important to note. This might indicate that he was the son of a renowned teacher. Now Jesus, on the other hand, who was he? Who was Jesus? We know Jesus. I hope we know Jesus. In contrast to Barabbas, he committed no crimes. He committed no sins. The only thing Jesus was guilty of was healing a demon-possessed man, restoring Jairus' daughter to life, healing a woman suffering with initial blood for 12 years, feeding 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, and having leftovers, by the way, healing those who were bound to beds, making the lame walk, the blind to see, inviting sinners into his home, treating women with respect, doing the will of God without hypocrisy. Jesus was perfectly innocent in spite of undergoing the same trials and temptations as any other man. And this is, in fact, what qualifies him to be the perfect sacrifice for humanity. Now, Jesus the Christ, in contrast to Jesus Barabbas, was, in fact, the Son of God. So Pilate apparently offered the Jews a choice between a Jesus who was the son of a teacher, assumed, and a Jesus who was the Son of God. And who did they choose to be released? Our next point. Let's turn over to Luke 23, where we're here, 18 through 24. Verses 18 through 24, same chapter. It says, and they all cried out at once, saying, away with this man and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder. Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus again, called out to them, but they shouted, saying, crucify him. Crucify him. Then he said to them the third time, why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified, and the voices of these men and of the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested, and he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison. But he delivered Jesus to their will. In Matthew 27 and 20, Matthew points out that the chief priests and the elders are the ones who persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas and destroy Jesus. And we see it here as well, but it's made more clear in Matthew. And again, we see injustice provoked by the power of influence. So it was done as the leaders expected. Jesus had been put in the place of even the worst criminal there was. So for anyone who thinks they are too sinful for grace and mercy, think again. Because Jesus' blood covers you too. There are no big or little sins. We are all equal in comparison to God. But the crowd shouted all at once, crucify him. And Pilate asked him one last time, at his third plea again, why, what evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. But Pilate acted hypocritically by suggesting that he only chastised Jesus and let him go. As much as he thought it was, there was no justice in that conclusion. Why would you punish a man for committing no crime? Even if it's the slightest. There was no punishment due Jesus. He had committed no crime. So though Pilate wishing to release Jesus, but also wanted to gratify the crowd more, he released Barabbas to them and washed his hands, as we mentioned. Don't be like Pilate. Don't compromise with truth. Stand up for truth, even if you have to stand alone. But Pilate feared that his relationship with Caesar would be destroyed. That's what mattered to him the most. The crowd ironically and prophetically yells, "Let his blood be upon us and our offspring." And this is exactly what would be the result of Jesus' death, at least for all those who would gather unto him and obey his gospel. His blood would be on all those who call on his name. This would actually reenact the Passover. But not in the days of Egypt, where the death angel passed over those who had the blood smeared over their doorposts. But this is in a new and spiritual way. All those who come in contact with the blood of Jesus through baptism. Jesus being the perfect sacrifice is contrasted with that of the law of Moses in Hebrew 10. For the sake of time, we're not going to read that chapter. I kept it short for you guys today. Trust me, I went home and chopped it up. I'm serious, y'all. Though this world may never show forth justice, this is my conclusion, y'all. To every man in life, while we yet live, in a world still reigning with sin, we should never expect it to. We should never expect to receive full justice in this world. But what we do know is this. God will execute justice in the last day toward every man. We know this because his church is the glimpse into the full revelation of it. Really quickly, I want to read a few passages. Let's turn over to Psalms. Psalms 33 and 5. I got a few of them for you guys. I also counted in the time that it take me to flip pages. 33 and 5 says, there we are. He loves righteousness and justice. The earth is full of the goodness of the Lord. Now, let's turn over to Isaiah. Isaiah 42, 1 through 4. Isaiah 42, 1 through 4. It reads, "Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my elect one in whom my soul delights, I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles. He will not cry out nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands shall wait for his law." Just a few chapters over, 58. Let's read verses 6 through 10. Isaiah 58, 6 through 10 says, "Is this not the fast that I have chosen? To loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the heavy burdens, to let the oppressed go free, and that you break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and that you bring to your house the poor who are cast out? When you see the naked, that you cover him and not hide yourself from your own flesh. Then your light shall break forth like the morning. Your healing shall spring forth speedily, and your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call and the Lord will answer. You shall cry and he will say, 'Here I am.'" Something has to be done about injustice. And though it is not wise, let me say this, to protest under certain circumstances, we must protest spiritually. And how do we do this? We do this by loving one another. We do this by loving all men. And we do this by demonstrating justice toward every man. We do this by teaching the gospel to every man we meet. We must point them in the way of truth. We must lead them toward the light to meet the God of justice. And when we fail to do so, at least to attempt to, when we fail to do this, we have nobody to blame but ourselves. We can't expect any change at all if we don't start with ourselves. That is, if we want things to change. So, for anyone who may be dealing with this particular sin, having an attitude of injustice, who shows forth injustice to the fellow man, this is the time that you can come and you can get rid of that weight and you can make yourself right with God. Now, for those who have not received justice spiritually, who have not received God's grace and mercy, you do this by being added to his church, being added to his body through baptism. Let's do this as together we stand and sing.